Our guests tonight are candidates for U.S. Senate who have registered more than 5% in recent public opinion polls. Senator Mark Begich, a Democrat, is seeking re-election for a second term before running for the U.S. Senate. Mr. Begich was mayor of Anchorage. He served on the Anchorage Assembly for 10 years. His Republican challenger is Dan Sullivan. He is a lawyer who served as an attorney general and natural resources commissioner for the state of Alaska. He was U.S. Assistant Secretary of State in the Bush administration. Joining me on our news panel is Liz Ruskin, Washington, D.C. correspondent for the Alaska Public Radio Network, and Dan Bross. He is a senior news reporter for KUAC Public Broadcasting in Fairbanks. Welcome to all of you.
Thank you.
First, a few rules. I'll let you know how much time you'll have to respond to each question. When you see a yellow light off to your side, that means that you have a few more seconds to complete your response. When you hear this bell, the time is up. I will enforce this as politely as possible. Earlier, we tossed a coin, and Mr. Begich won the right to answer the first question. You will have 45 seconds in this particular round. Let's start with a question from Dan Bross.
Mr. Begich, your campaign slogan has been, you'll go anywhere and talk to anyone. How concerned are you that about negative campaigning and the effect it may have had in walling you off from some constituents?
Well, as you just said, I'll go anywhere, talk to anyone about what's important for Alaska. And I go all over the state. I've traveled as many places you can imagine. And I think it doesn't matter if you agree or disagree with me. I will sit there and have a conversation. I go on a conservative talk radio. And as you can imagine, that sometimes people aren't very happy with some of my decisions. But we sit there and have a conversation. I think that's important. But your broader question, I think it's important that we talk about the record of my opponent or others. But I ran, I think, a fairly positive campaign. When you think about the campaign commercials I've talked about, the oil and gas development on the Arctic, or veterans care, and the issues of women's health, and all these other, what I think are very important issues we should be talking about. But I'll go anywhere, talk to anybody about what's important to Alaska.
Mr. Sullivan, you maintain that Mr. Begich supports the agenda of President Obama and Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid. Who among sitting politicians in Washington would you align yourself with?
Well, you know, Liz, one of the things on this campaign, we've had a bunch of several U.S. senators who have endorsed my campaign. And it's what I like about it, it's a very broad-based coalition of senators. It's Senator Murkowski, of course, but it's Rand Paul has done an ad on TV. We had Senator Barrasso up here as a physician. We had Senator Corker up here campaigning for me. So I like to, what I've been very interested in, both in terms of Republicans, but even beyond Republicans, is working with all different elements of the Republican Party. One of the candidates, or a Republican that I like, Marco Rubio, young, crosses many bridges in terms of different ideas, but there's a lot of great Republicans and Democrats that I'd like to work for if I was a U.S. Senator.
Okay, you've just named everyone across the board. Which of those would you say are you the most alike?
That I'm most alike?
Yes, of the senators.
Well, I mean, I'm going to come to the U.S. Senate if I have the honor of being elected as a Dan Sullivan Republican. And that's somebody who works with all different groups, stakeholders, to develop strategies to address challenges. That's been my record in Alaska as Attorney General, as DNR Commissioner, as an Assistant Secretary of State, and as a Lieutenant Colonel in the Marines. So I'm certainly somebody who's for less government, more freedom, and very focused on rolling back the Obama administration's agenda. But, you know, it depends on the issue, I would say. You know, Senator Murkowski, if I'm able to win and Harry Reid is retired as Senate Majority Leader, Lisa Murkowski will be the chair of the Senate Energy and Resources Committee. I'll work with her on energy issues, that's for sure, with regard to energy in Alaska.
All right, let's move on. Mr. Sullivan, as of this afternoon, nearly $57 million has been spent on this race. What's your assessment of how this spending has served to inform and motivate Alaskan voters? Have there been benefits from this spending?
Well, Laura, you know, one of the things that we recognized early on was how much money was going to be spent in this race. And we recognized it was going to be a challenge, almost a flood of mostly outside money, third-party outside money, supporting me, supporting Mark. And so we saw that as a challenge not only in our race, but for all races, right? I think it's kept many other races off the air, both TV and radio. So we put forward, I put forward an agreement to Mark called the Alaska Agreement. It was very similar to the agreement that was put forward in the 2012 Massachusetts Senate race, almost identical to that. That work that was between Elizabeth Warren and Scott Brown kept the money off, kept the outside money off the airwaves, and it was unfortunate that Mark did not. He had plenty of time to sign it. He didn't, and I think the vast majority of Alaskans wanted that to be signed. That would have helped.
Mr. Begich, $57 million is unprecedented. Does this level of spending help voters understand the issues and propel them to the polls?
I think it's oversaturation. I think voters are agitated by the mail. I can tell you the YouTube ads that my opponent has on every single day attacking me. I think people don't like it. But let me respond really quickly first to the agreement that Dan talked about. That agreement was a press release. He sent it over 15 minutes before then. They announced it out there. The reality is 60% of this money is spent in October, the month of October. An independent group came to us, along with an Alaska group called ACBRG, and I supported that, signed it on disclosure. Dan didn't sign it, but we can go back and forth on it. But here's the real fundamental issue. Are we going to overturn Citizens United, a Supreme Court ruling that said that corporations are citizens or individuals, and they're not. They're not people. My opponent has not supported that idea. I support a constitutional amendment to change it. I also support legislation on the federal level to disclose, like we have for the Alaska law, who the top three donors are in these groups. But he has refused to support those pieces of legislation.
I'd like to ask a follow-up about campaign finance reform. Would you support a law?
Look, I think what Mark has proposed, what Harry Reid has proposed, is something that, in my view, is quite radical. That's never happened before, amending the First Amendment. Everybody from the ACLU to Ted Kennedy to conservative groups is against that. With all due respect to Mark and Harry Reid, I'll stick with James Madison writing of the First Amendment than a rewriting of the First Amendment. And again, we had the opportunity, you know, he talked about the money being spent at the end. We knew this was going to be a problem. We gave him that agreement. It wasn't a press conference. You had 2, 3, 4, or 5 weeks to sign that agreement.
No to campaign finance reform?
So, I mean, I'll look at anything, but as I mentioned, I'm not in favor at all of amending the First Amendment of the United States Constitution, which he is.
I'd like to give you 30 seconds to campaign finance reform.
The Supreme Court decided that corporations are people. They're not people. They don't go down to the courthouse and get married. They're not people. And the reality is, if you want to get this third-party money out, you got to go and amend the Constitution back to what it means, and that is individuals are individuals, corporations are not. That is fact. You have refused. It's not a Harry Reid. I know you like to use Harry Reid and Obama all the time because that's your talking points. But the other question is a simple law change that would at least require disclosure. That, like Alaska laws, we have that here. When you run an Alaska campaign, not a federal, you have to disclose the top three donors. That's Alaska law. Alaskans have spoken on that. And so that bill is pending right now that I'm a sponsor on with Senator Udall. So the question, I think, is we even support that?
We are off to a lively start. Let's go now to military issues. You will have 1 minute to respond to this question. Dan Bross will have our first question for Mr. Sullivan.
Mr. Sullivan, the U.S. is using airstrikes to combat ISIS. At what point would American ground forces, in an offensive manner, be warranted?
Well, you know, we've talked about this. We've debated it. Those are combat troops already engaged, right? So I think there's been some confusion on what a combat troop is. A pilot flying airstrikes is a combat troop.
I agree with you. What about ground forces?
So, I mean, from my perspective, it depends on what the mission is. I think there's certainly ground forces to go rescue pilots. I was a commander of a Marine task force that did that for the Special Operations Task Force. Also to save American personnel. You know, we had an incident in Benghazi where we had a company of Marines on the ground in Benghazi, we wouldn't have a dead ambassador. So where I've had a disagreement with Mark is he's saying that we should never have ground forces on the ground. And I say it should be a contingency. Why would we ever want to signal to our enemies, and ISIS is an enemy and they're a threat, that we will never have ground forces on the ground and give them that comfort? We should not give our enemies that kind of comfort. It's a contingency. In terms of ground force use, my broader criticism is that this administration has not put together a broader, comprehensive strategy with all instruments of American power to defeat ISIS and laid out a clear
let's
mission.
Move on. Thank you.
Aside from an individual unit, say, going in to address a situation, what about the kind of response like we had in Afghanistan or in Iraq?
Well, I've never, and we had a debate last night, I've never called for a massive amount of ground troops at all. And I, you know, Mark last night in a debate said I was gung-ho to get to have ground troops in there. That's not the case at all. I'm a commander of a Marine Corps Reserve unit whose very mission is to deploy with foreign armies to call in airstrikes. I would have skin in the game in this very situation. What I'm interested in is having a clearly defined mission, and then being able to carry that out. And we have not had that yet from this administration.
Mr. Begich, we know you oppose boots on the ground, but is there at some point some kind of trigger point where that would be justified in your mind?
Well, let me, I know Dan attempted to answer that, but your question is a very good question. And I have, you're absolutely right, I don't support massive forces down there doing what we've done in Iraq and Afghanistan. We have tried that in Iraq, and what happened? We thought we trained these troops. As soon as ISIS moved in, what happened? Iraq literally backed up, left military weaponry there for ISIS to pick up. But let me go back to the original question, the broader question, that is, I haven't supported funding the rebels. I think the president was wrong on that. We don't know who these rebels are. 12 months ago, they were ISIS. Today, they're someone else. Tomorrow, they could be a whole other group that becomes our enemies. We have so much need here in this country with our veterans and veterans care. That's where I want to put our resources. I have supported the airstrikes because they're multinational, and that is having some impact. I think they should go in there, be a lot harder on the money issues, and that means the oil wells and the refineries that ISIS is using to fund their operations should be dealt with aggressively so we cut off their money. But the Arab countries need to step up. This is their region. They need to be at the table, and that means on the ground. And let me make it very clear. We got embassies there within that region. We got personnel. We need to protect them. But putting massive ground troops like Afghanistan, Iraq, no, I'm not interested.
So you don't see any trigger point for that?
No, I think it's important that the Arab countries there, you know, we continually go back to this region and try to solve the problems that the region is unwilling to take on and solve themselves. I mean, look what Turkey. Turkey today, you can read their articles about it. They're reluctant. They're supposed to be our ally. They're reluctant to now participate. They like what's happening in an odd way with the Kurds, and you know, Iran is now a partner with Iraq. I mean, it's a zone that we try to go in and always meddle in. And my view is, they need to step up to the plate and be the ground troops if they want to change the region and create sustainability there.
Okay, you mentioned reluctance to fund or arm rebel groups. I want to give Mr. Sullivan a chance on that. What about arming or funding rebel groups?
I was supportive. You know, one of the things that I've been critical of Mark is that saying no to every option is not foreign policy. Inaction, as we have seen over the last several years, creates its own consequences. And right now, there's no doubt that we have a serious threat, not only with regard to ISIS, but other areas that are going on in the world. One of the things I've been critical of this administration on is that they've initially, during the first term, showed weakness, withdrew from the world in terms of American engagement, thinking somehow that the world would be a fine place, talked about leading from behind. And then from my perspective, you know, when you show weakness, that's provocative. And we're not only seeing it with regard to ISIS, we're certainly seeing it with regard to Iran and their quest for a nuclear weapon, which I think is probably the biggest threat. A terrorist regime in Tehran with a nuclear weapon is a huge threat to the United States and our allies in the region. And we're seeing it in Russia and China. So we have a lot of challenges in the world right now. One of the things that I've been saying is, as someone who's currently a lieutenant colonel in the Marines, a former assistant secretary of state who's worked on these issues, I'll be ready on day one to deal with them.
Let's wrap up and move on with Liz. Your next question.
Yes, Mr. Sullivan. The military has been struggling to deal with sexual assault within the ranks. Do you support Senator Gillibrand's bill that would take military sexual assault cases outside the chain of command? Is the current system, which puts a lot of power in the hands of a suspect's commander, defensible?
Well, you know, Liz, we had a discussion on this last night, and I'm someone who is very focused on this issue. As a U.S. senator, I will be very focused on it. The one thing I have with the concerns about the Gillibrand proposal is that what we really need is more accountability with regard to the commanders of these units. Of all units. And one thing I fear about that proposal is that it takes accountability away. So let me give you an example. If there was a soldier who was assaulted, normally you would want to have that culture of that unit make sure that doesn't happen, and if it does, there's accountability. if with taking it away from the chain of command could bring up the prospect that the soldier could go to a commander and that person, the commander, would say, hey, lawyers are going to deal with that. Now, what I have been supportive of is Claire McCaskill, Kelly Ayotte, senators, bipartisan, both former prosecutors, have put forward proposals in the National Defense Authorization of 2014 to make it so commanders can't overturn convictions and to make it so every victim has an assigned JAG officer to them. There are a lot of proposals that are good.
Thanks, Mr. Sullivan.
This one's not a silver bullet.
Thank you.
Mr. Begich, we know you support Senator Gillibrand's bill. What about the argument that unit commanders can deal with bad soldiers more effectively and that where victims have been ignored or worse, that it's because of bad commanders, not a bad system?
Well, I think that, first off, the bill that's been passed, and the Gillibrand bill, I think has all the conditions to go after these commanders also, but the difference is you take it outside the command structure when it's time to deal with these perpetrators and protect the victims. So you can still deal with these commanders that are doing bad jobs and their responsibility dealing with their troops. But here's what I've heard from victims. Victims who have been in the military, people who are currently in the military, what they want to be able to have is a process that they don't feel threatened by their commanders or the perception of being threatened or their potential of being promoted or having a situation that's talked about within their unit, and they want to have a separate situation, a separate plan, and how they can go after and deal with this issue. Taking it out of the system is important. That does not mean that the commanders are not going to be held accountable, because clearly, if you have someone who's been a victim of sexual harassment or sexual assault, clearly the commander is going to have to be dealt with also in a separate process through the command structure. But the victim should be outside the command structure, because I do believe there is a fear among people within the military. I hear it. I've talked to the victims. I've had several meetings here in Anchorage, several back in Washington, D.C. That is the right approach, to take it outside of the command structure.
Thank you. We're going to allow some time now for candidates to ask questions of each other. You will have, please keep your questions succinct. You will have 1 minute to respond, and then the person who is asking the question will have 30 seconds for a rebuttal if you so choose. We'll start with Mr. Begich. You can ask the first question of Mr. Sullivan.
You bet. As a member of the Appropriations Committee, Dan, I know you've been concerned about the federal spending and the process. Do you support advanced appropriations, for example, with the VA or other agencies?
Excuse me, Mark. Can you repeat the question?
Sure. Do you support advanced appropriation bills or process for our federal agencies, for example, like the VA?
Well, look, what I support is funding, and I've heard this as I've talked to many many communities in particularly rural Alaska, that the process of the continuing resolution is no way to run a government, and it's no way to help with regard to entities, whether it's clinics, whether it's agencies, whether it's schools, to get consistent funding. So one of the things that I've been critical of in terms of the last few years, particularly the last 6 years as you've been a senator, is that there's only been two budgets passed in 6 years. So what I'm for is a budget process where the Senate actually undertakes its constitutional duty to pass a budget, which is what every household, every business in Alaska does, and which is what the U.S. Senate has only done twice in the 6 years in which you have served in the U.S. Senate. So I'm for consistency, planning, and a budget process that's required by the Constitution that Harry Reid and you have not been undertaking.
Would you like 30 seconds to respond?
Yeah, let me just respond. Advanced funding ensures, we did this, for example, with the VA healthcare system, so when there's a government shutdown or any interruption of the federal government, it doesn't stop the payments. The person you're bringing up here this weekend, Ted Cruz, the master of the government shutdown, the idea of this is to ensure that the VA, and that's why I support a bill, it's bipartisan, I'm the co-sponsor on it, we're going to pass this bill, and the objective is to make sure we don't have this situation, there's government interruptions. Ted Cruz, who you're inviting up here, is the king of shutting down the government. What would this bill do to ensure? Then it would ensure that we don't have delays in disability payments, delay in GI benefits, delays in the situation with spouses taking care of their wounded warriors.
Thank you.
So advance funding is a great way to move funding forward in a 2-year process.
And so is passing Senate budgets, as the Constitution requires.
Mr. Sullivan, it's your opportunity now to ask a question of Mr. Begich, and you'll have about 20 seconds to ask. Mr. Begich, you have 1 minute to answer.
So, Mark, one of the things that I have discussed is your record of voting with President Obama, 97, and then this year, 98% of the time. And you haven't really campaigned on your record of doing that, but can you explain why you voted for Barack Obama not once but twice during his elections?
Dan, you know, I wondered, I know this, there's no commercials allowed on public radio or TV, but I figured Obama would be brought up multiple times because you don't have a commercial running. But let me say this. I've made that statement about who I voted for, but my record is an Alaska record. There's been times when I've disagreed with the president, clearly. He's wrong on gun rights. He was wrong on the issue of oil and gas development. We had to push him. Now we're moving forward on National Petroleum Reserve and oil and gas exploration there for the first time since 1923 in development. Arctic has opened up. He was wrong when he tried to raise the rates on our postal services throughout Alaska by 50%. We fought that. We won that. When he tried to increase the TSA or the fees for our landing for our general aviation planes, we won that. So my record is an Alaska record. And I'm very proud. For example, my voting record with Senator Murkowski, 80% of the time this last year on every single issue in front of us. On top of that, when you look at the National Journal, who looks at all the senators from 1 to 100, where do I fall every time? About 48, 52, kind of right in the middle. Because Alaskans understand that I'm pro-gun, pro-development in oil and gas, believe in our civil liberties and civil rights, as well as pro-choice, and so that's who I represent, Alaskans.
Thank you. Would you like 30 seconds?
Well, look, I think that what you've been saying is that President Obama's irrelevant, and I couldn't disagree more. As he said it himself, his policies are on the ballot this election, and you have supported his policies the vast, vast majority of the time. You know, that is a Congressional Quarterly roll call, nonpartisan ranking, 98% of the time.
Let me finish, please.
In 2014, what is the critical issue in this election? You're saying it doesn't matter. I say it's critical because the Obama administration's agenda, these massive bills that you've passed, the tens of thousands of pages of regulations are either going to be cemented into our society. We're going to start to roll them back.
Thank you.
My goal is to roll them back, and I think
your role
is to continue.
Thank you. Wrap it up. You have an opportunity to ask another question if you would like to do so, Mr. Begich.
I would be happy to. Dan, you and I had a conversation in the one of few debates, but we had one very early on, right after the primary, and I asked you a question about privacy issues in regard to the Patriot Act. Would you support reauthorization of the Patriot Act? As you know, that will come in front of Congress soon enough, as well as your views in regards to NSA. But specifically, would you reauthorize the Patriot Act that will come up in front of Congress at some point here again?
Well, what I've said is that I think the Patriot Act needs...
Yes or no?
No, it's not a yes or no question. The Patriot Act needs reform, and I believe it needs to take a significant reform, particularly as it relates to the issues of personal privacy and the NSA. I think that Congress has not done a great job in terms of oversight with the NSA. I think that what's positive now is you have two different cases going through the court system. But when you talk about personal privacy, Mark, one of the things that I find rather ironic is as the deciding vote on Obamacare, that has to be one of the most invasive federal laws in U.S. history, where medical information, the most private information, is given to government bureaucrats, not only HHS, but it's overseen by the IRS. So when you're talking about personal privacy and laws, it's a little ironic given that Obamacare is one of the most invasive laws in U.S. history with regard to personal privacy, federal bureaucrats, and overseen by two agencies that, to be quite frank, don't have a good record with regard to personal privacy at all, particularly the IRS.
30 seconds to respond,
well,
Mr. Begich.
Again, I wanted to focus on the Patriot Act. I'm sure we're going to talk about health care at some point in this debate, but let me, again, you did not answer the question.
No, you didn't answer the question.
The Patriot Act.
Please let him finish.
Yeah, the Patriot Act comes in front of us as reauthorization. That's how it's come in front of us three times, which I have voted against. What's more amazing is some of the invasion of privacy that's occurring by groups that support you. For example, this latest hoopla in regards to these letters that are being sent to people about their voting history, threatening to them. These are people that support your third-party groups that are pounding away and trying to make a difference in this campaign, but they are the people that also are invading privacy. They are financial supporters of yours. So I'm not sure your view of privacy is in line with what Alaska's view is.
All right, Mr. Sullivan, would you like to ask another question of Mr. Brennan?
Yes. So, Mark, you know, I believe campaigns are about character. And you've run both of your Senate campaigns in 2008 and 2014 by attacking your opponents, saying Alaskans can't trust them. You did this to Senator Ted Stevens, the late Senator Ted Stevens, in 2008. Knowing what you know now, that Ted Stevens was wrongly convicted by corrupt Justice Department lawyers and was an honorable man throughout his entire career, do you regret the TV ads you ran against Senator Stevens in 2008, and have you apologized to his family?
Actually, Dan, I don't know if you saw that campaign, but I ran ads about what I wanted to do for Alaska. I didn't run attack ads.
Yeah, you did.
No, I didn't, Dan. I know the campaign. I was here. And the fact is, the campaign ads I talked about was the importance of Alaska. Matter of fact, when I decided to run for office against Ted Stevens, I called him up. We had a conversation about that. Because, and he said, good luck on the campaign trail. Because as an Alaskan, born and raised here with history in this state, like Ted Stevens, a man who did incredible things for our state, I didn't disagree with, you know, what was happening. I kept away from that issue. Matter of fact, we had a debate right here in this room, and I didn't have that conversation about it because I believed that was an issue he had to deal with. That was always my press commentary on that. But the issue was I believed I offered a different future for Alaska, a different perspective. That's what I campaigned on, the issues of Alaska. And the debates that he was able to do, and some were by video or some were with surrogates, we talked about the issues instead of attacking people, Dan. So maybe you should go back and look at those campaigns.
Now, I have.
Well, I'm telling you, the campaign commercials I paid for, the campaign commercials I paid for, the ones that I was involved in, we talked about the record. And that's what I'm proud to say. I had a great record, and I was able to talk about it as mayor, and
Thank
we talked about the issues.
Thank you. Would you like 30 seconds to
sure.
respond?
Well, as I mentioned, I think campaigns are about character. And one of the things that's been disappointing in this campaign, I think that your campaign's starting to receive national attention, which has become an embarrassment to Alaskans. Time magazine, the LA Times, USA Today have all cited your campaign as running some of the most dishonest attack ads of the entire election cycle. And I think that what I've been wanting to do in this campaign is talk about the issue. If you look at the Sullivan for U.S. Senate campaign ads, my campaign ads, they don't get those kind of awards. It's about my record. It's about my vision.
Okay.
And yes, it can be about your record sometimes as well.
All right, thank you, gentlemen. Thank you very much for that exchange. Let's move on now to the U.S. economy. And Liz will have our first question in this segment for Mr. Sullivan. Please keep your answers to 1 minute.
Yes, I'd like to ask you both about the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. This was created by the Dodd-Frank legislation in the wake of the lending crisis. It has so far delivered $3 billion to consumers in settlements with financial institutions over fraudulent lending. Mr. Sullivan, you've said you'd vote to abolish the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Why do you think this bureau should be abolished?
Well, first of all, Liz, I'm somebody who believes in the Constitution and abiding by it. And, you know, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau is actually underneath the Fed. And I think there's serious questions on the constitutionality of it. But let me make a broader point, as that was all part of Dodd-Frank, with not only the legislation that was passed, but the regulations that came out of that. And it's very similar in some ways to Obamacare. You talk to small community bankers in Alaska. They are so overburdened with the regulations from Dodd-Frank that they feel that they can't even move forward. It is crushing our small community bankers. I've talked to them throughout this state. One of the most famous bankers in the state mentioned to me that the bank that his family started, they could not do that today, given the over-regulation of the banking system. And they've mentioned in particular the CFTC, or the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, as an entity that's not helping, but actually a burden to actually getting loans out to small businessmen,
okay,
small business women, and keeping our economy
Thank
moving.
Thank you. Mr. Begich, do you think that the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau is doing its job? Are you concerned that it is hampering commerce?
I think, first off, I think it is doing its job in some ways, as you've identified in your original beginning of the question. It has saved consumers millions, in some cases billions of dollars of better regulation to manage that. Also, military people, there's a special unit within there to figure out, and a lot of our military, active military, have been ripped off by payday loans and these other programs. This organization goes right after them to protect our military families, and I think it has done a good job there. Now, there are pieces that they've gone too far. For example, the credit unions, I believe, are getting overburdened on the paperwork they have to do. They were not part of the financial crisis, but everyone kind of got swept up into it because the financial situation in this country, which was a disaster when we came in, when I came into office, and we had to do something to get some control on this, so we no longer have taxpayer bailed out situations. These banks that did so much harm to this country, and many people lost retirements, lost their education accounts and others, that it's important that we make sure these banks are held accountable. And it's critical that we make sure that the regulation is protective of the consumer at the same time. And I think consumers got a big short end of the stick when those banks started to fail, and it was outrageous. And so this bill helped bring that into alignment.
Thank you.
Mr. Begich, according to the Federal Reserve, the richest 5% of American households hold more than 60% of the nation's wealth. Is this trend compatible with the high value Americans place on equality of opportunity? Do you think Congress should work toward shrinking the wealth gap?
Well, I think we have a couple things we can do here, and your statistic is right. It's amazing the gap that's occurred, and it's probably one of the things I hear about so much when I'm on the road talking to people at town hall meetings, this concern, this huge continuing gap. I've sponsored a piece of legislation with the finance chairman as well as a Republican to do a tax reform piece of legislation. We haven't had tax reform since 1986. And because of that, all these special deals have been kind of put in there over the years to really benefit the 1%, basically, or the 5%, but really the top end, and has really put at risk the middle-class Americans. This piece of legislation does something very basic, flattens the rates down to 3, ensures that middle-class Americans continue to have their deductions for child care tax credit, for mortgage interest on their home, or education expenses, medical expenses, and these basic things that really make a difference for middle class. We also strip out all these loopholes. You know, we give tax breaks to corporations that send jobs overseas. It makes no sense. So we strip that out and lower the corporate rates so we're more competitive. I think if we can do that and also raise the minimum wage on the national level, which I do support, will make a big difference to raise up the poverty level of this country.
Mr. Sullivan, same question.
So, you know, Liz, I think income inequality is an issue. I think the broader issue, though, over the last several years has been economic growth. And, you know, we did have a major, major recession, no doubt about it. But what's typical in American economic history is when you actually have a deep recession, the recovery is usually quite steep and strong. And unfortunately, we've had the weakest recovery out of any major recession in U.S. history. So until the last quarter, we've only been growing at about 2% GDP growth. This is anemic American growth rates. It's much less than it was under Reagan, under Clinton, and the first term of Bush. What we need to do is unleash our economic and energy potential. And I don't think there's a mystery on how to do it. It is the overregulation of the U.S. economy, which is every Alaskan has a story about that. It is the number one issue that I see on the campaign trail. If we can do that, roll back these mountain of regs that have come from these bills like Dodd-Frank and Obamacare, and then unleash our energy potential. You know, the U.S. is now on the verge of being the world's energy superpower again. Largest producer of oil in the world, largest producer of natural gas in the world, largest producer of renewables in the world. Alaska should be leading that. But again, we need a federal government that's a partner in seizing that opportunity on energy. And right now, not only in Alaska, but for most of the country, they've been an obstacle.
Well, we've come out of the Great Recession, but the income gap continues to grow. So if we just grow the economy, that won't solve the wealth gap, will it?
Well, I think growing the economy is the critical issue. And, you know, I think also we talk about job growth in this administration. We see these lower unemployment rates. But what that is masking is that that's not because of significant job growth. That is because Americans are actually leaving the workforce. The unemployment rate comes down when people quit looking for jobs. We're at the highest level of Americans who are out of the workforce since the late 1970s. What we need to do is create an economy at growth rates that create jobs, and to me, that's the number one issue, job growth over income inequality.
Thank you.
A proven means of personal economic advancement is higher education, but the cost of going to college is just too high for many Americans. Mr. Begich, I'll start with you. What can the federal government do to help?
Absolutely.
The
federal government has a significant role there because we have loans that we are able to give the students, and we also have Pell Grants and other programs. But here's a couple of things. First off, on the loans, I've supported two pieces of legislation that would lower the rates. We already passed one that's already in law now that gets the rate about 3.83%. But the problem is it floats up, so we've got to be very careful. So I've supported legislation to fix that rate, to make sure it's a permanent, so we have, people know certainty in the years ahead. Second to this, we have people out there already that have loans from the private sector as well as from the government that I propose an idea along with other senators to consolidate that, lower the rate to 4%. But the better one, I think, and I don't know if we have the chance to get this one passed, but it's a bill that's on the table, and that is we loan banks at 0.75% to loan out to banks who sometimes fail. But why not just make it 1.75%, fix it just a little above what the Fed's loan for, and loan that out to students? Because the best return, if you want to grow an economy, education's where it's at. My parents were educators. My sisters are educators. My sister-in-law just retired. Education is the core to building any economy, and lowering these costs is critical for the long-term growth of this country.
Thank you.
Dan, I think, again, the best thing we do for students graduating from universities is have great opportunity for them in Alaska and throughout the country. The other thing that is a huge comparative advantage for the United States in terms of our economy, in terms of our future, we have the best universities, the best university systems in the world by far. And I've had the great privilege of attending a few of those. But one of the things, again, that I'm concerned about is you see this encroachment with regard to the federal government getting very, very involved in our higher education system, which I don't think is healthy for these world-class institutions. So the federal government can play a role, particularly on that research aspect, with the great research universities that the federal government can play a role in. But under this administration, the encroachment of a greater federal government involvement with our great higher institutions of learning, I don't think is a healthy trend.
What about personally with students, though, in terms of supporting them?
You mean in terms of student loans?
Right.
Well, I think those are important programs, and we want to give students opportunities to make sure they're able to pay those loans back. I mean, as you know, a lot of people who go for higher education, particularly beyond the four-year degrees, come out of being doctors and lawyers with huge debt. So I think we need to make that competitive. But again, to me, the best way for students to be able to pay back loans is to have a healthy economy and good jobs, and we haven't seen that in the last 6 years.
Let's move on to some issues that are important to Alaska Natives in the state of Alaska. Gentlemen, you'll have 1 minute to answer these questions, and we are going to start with Liz or Mr. Sullivan.
Yes. Mr. Sullivan, current federal law does not allow Alaska Native tribes to issue domestic violence restraining orders against non-members. Do you favor changing federal law to give them that authority?
Well, I think that's an issue that is important to work with tribes, the state, and the federal government, the Department of Justice, right? I know that there's the there's some acts that the Village Safe Families Act that has been sponsored, that the Department of Justice is still looking at that very issue. But one of the things that I've been very focused on in my career was working in the rural communities, going out to the rural communities, recognizing that we had challenges and taking action to do it. So this was Joe Masters, myself, under the Governor Parnell, where we recognized we had to dramatically increase law enforcement in the rural communities, not nearly enough law enforcement out there. And we did that. We've been increasing the VPSOs, VPOs, troopers in the rural communities, almost tripled the numbers of VPSOs over the last 5 years. I was just in Hooper Bay, saw a great example of VPSOs, VPOs, and a new trooper working together. We need to do more. The key is having tribes, the state, and the feds working together on these important issues and building capacity for tribal courts law enforcement.
Do you think, the question was about tribal court authority, do you think they should have the authority under their own power, not just in cooperation with the state and the federal government, but do you think under their own power they should have the authority to be able to issue domestic violence restraining orders against non-members?
Well, I think right now the state is already enforcing those orders, so in some ways the state Attorney General's office, prosecutors, are in some ways ahead of the federal government on these issues. To me, it's a complicated question, not only for Alaska, but for the rest of the country. And this is why having people working together on it, the state, the Department of Justice, the tribes, on this, it's an important issue, but it's not an easy one. And I think that's the approach I would take as a U.S. senator, but I will be very focused on law enforcement in the rural communities as I have been as Attorney General.
Mr. Begich, the same question for you, please.
Well, let me go first to one piece, and I want to, you know, it's interesting that Dan talks about being focused on this. He was Attorney General. One of the big fundamental pieces here, the state doesn't recognize the tribes. As Attorney General, he could have probably implemented something to work on that and make that happen. But let's get to your issue. Having communities and tribes take responsibility and have an opportunity to have tribal courts, I support that. That is why the bill that Dan mentioned, the Safe Families and Village Act, does that. The Justice Department actually is working with us. They already like the bill. We're moving forward on this because it makes sense. When I was mayor and someone visited my city and they came in and committed a crime, if they weren't a resident, I still dealt with them. It didn't matter where they came from. And I think if we want to really combat these issues, we do need to engage the tribes at a level that they want. And matter of fact, I met a gentleman at the Alaska Council of Village Presidents in Bethel from Hooper Bay, and he actually talked specifically about this idea. He is begging for this so their communities can deal with these problems of sexual assault, domestic violence, substance abuse. So obviously I'm a big fan of it because I think we need to have tribes be engaged. Look how good tribes have worked with regards to our health care law, you know, in the sense of delivering health care throughout our state. Give them the ability, and they will produce incredible results. We should have faith in them. We don't need the state to tell them always what to do. Let the tribes move forward in this area of public safety, because it hasn't worked. We have double amount of people from the Alaska Native community incarcerated. We still have high rates of sexual assault, substance abuse, domestic violence in our rural communities. We need to try something different, and this, I believe, is an opportunity to make a huge impact.
If I may ask a follow-up, but when we're talking about enforcing tribal law against non-members, what are the limits of that?
Well,
because municipality of Anchorage has borders. Are you talking about making sort of quasi-borders around villages?
They're going to be, you know, as our piece of legislation lays out, it lays out a geographical area, but it's basically where that region is. But it may not be, as you know, as you describe, here's the border of the land, but where the tribes have jurisdiction. There are historic
as far as Anchorage?
No, I think there are clearly, especially in the very rural areas, as you know, it's demonstration projects. They work with the Justice Department the way we've laid it out so they can define those areas as well as what would be covered. Because I know there's this fear, and I know the state who opposes my legislation believes it's going to be suddenly all throughout Alaska, the whole state will be tribal control. That's not the way it works. But for us not to take advantage of a tribe that's wanting to change the way their system works to improve the lives of their community, we should be jumping right in there to see what we can do. That's what this bill does.
Thank you. Please wrap up.
Mr. Begich, the Denali Commission has funded a lot of village infrastructure, including safe water and sewer systems, as well as fuel tank upgrades. Commission funding has gone from a high of $140 million in 2005 to the current budget request of $14 million. It's literally been decimated. There have been efforts to zero it out. What do you see as the future of the Denali Commission? Would you increase, decrease the funding?
Yeah, actually, the delegation has been working on this to reauthorize or actually have a piece of legislation. As you know, that was funded through earmarks. Earmarks are not allowed within the Senate or the House, so that's where a lot of that money came from. Well, what have I done in the meantime? Besides just working on the legislation with the delegation to make sure that funding happens into the future, securing the baseline funding that you talk about, but doing several other things that impact rural Alaska. The small boat harbor program, which we added to the Corps of Engineer bill. It used to be only for Guam, Puerto Rico, and Hawaii. We added Alaska for that. Why did we do that? Because now there's money going to, for example, Petersburg and Sitka, money to help those small ports. Or we put aside in our telecommunications legislation a $50 million fund, which these go into perpetuity. In other words, these are funds that are permanent.
These are outside the Denali fund?
Yes, but we know the Denali Commission, as we work through it, I'm finding other avenues to do the exact same thing in other ways. For example, that $50 million fund for tribes for the whole nation, Alaska got $40 million of it this last year. When we think of the Farm Bill, we had money in there for safe waters. We increased that and making sure that money goes to rural areas. Just USDA alone, the last 6 years, $3.5 billion to rural communities.
Thank you.
Mr. Sullivan, the future of the Denali Commission, it sounds...
Yeah, I think, Liz, you make a good point that it has been decimated, and I think it's been, in many ways, from a lack of leadership and a lack of vision. My view is that it should be re-energized with a vision focusing on infrastructure, and that would include sewer and water. You know, again, having spent a lot of time out in the rural communities over the last several years, that's an issue that I don't think anybody should compromise on. It's the health of Alaskans, of Americans. But the other area that I think the Denali Commission can be very focused on, and there's a huge amount of opportunity, is bringing down the high cost of energy in the rural communities. It's the number one issue that I think is undermining the opportunities there.
Outside but the Denali Commission or with the Denali
within Commission? Within the Denali Commission, but I think one of the things that we haven't done a good enough job with regard to particularly addressing the high cost of energy is to make sure we're starting to look at much more opportunities for public-private partnerships. Let me give you an example. We now have a boom in terms of energy in Cook Inlet. I'm proud to have played a leadership role on that over the last 3 to 4 years. But we now have the opportunity possibly to be shipping gas into some of the rural communities from Cook Inlet. That's a great opportunity. There's private sector companies that are already looking at small-scale LNG barges to our rural communities. When we have more resources in the state and we can ship them to different parts of the state, it provides great opportunities for public-private partnerships,
which has
to be the new way we're thinking on some of these issues.
Thank you. Dan, let's
Mr. Begich, the Bureau of Land Management yesterday issued its final supplemental environmental impact statement on ConocoPhillips' proposed Moose's Tooth project in NPRA, the National Petroleum Reserve, Alaska. The preferred alternative includes wells, an access road. Is this something to be celebrated as careful review of development in a sensitive area, or is it an overdue step in an overbearing regulatory process?
Well, you know, when you look at that, you got to look at the whole National Petroleum Reserve. As you know, the original was CD5, and I know my opponent and I have a little disagreement. They forget that some of these situations were set up in the past administration with EIS studies and others that weren't completed properly, so we got litigated on it. But take CD5, GMT1 you're talking about. I look at things always as a glass half full, not half empty. And it's important that we look at what this means. We are moving forward. This means that we're going to have 16,000 barrels of oil from CD5 starting next year coming out of National Petroleum Reserve. The following year, because of GMT1, that will bring another 30,000, filling the pipeline where the state has failed to do that. We're now putting oil into that pipeline. National Petroleum Reserve, and again, my opponent and I disagree on this, that, you know, he believes it's all locked up or half it's locked up, which is incorrect. He always makes that statement. When we were in negotiations with the state or with the federal government to figure out how much we could develop, Dan Sullivan is a Natural Resources Commission, and the governor walked away from the table. I don't believe in that. You don't walk away from the table. You stay right in there, and you keep on fighting. And that's why GMT1's going, and just yesterday is at ConocoPhillips, and GMT2 is probably the next project. But you don't walk away from the table, no matter what the obstacles are.
Thank you.
Mr. Sullivan, GMT2, the Greater Moose's Tooth Unit, yeah, in NPRA, that decision that came out yesterday with a preferred alternative,
right,
too little, too late?
I certainly am not somebody who celebrates it, and I am definitely a glass half full guy, right? Without the federal government's help, we turned a Cook Inlet basin around in 4 years. People said it was dead. It's booming, right? But what we've seen, you know, particularly with the NPRA, is an Obama administration that overreaches, that ignores the rule of law, and that constantly delays resource development. You know, Mark, you keep talking about this as some kind of success. In 2010, when everybody thought that we were getting ready to get that bridge approved, what happened? the Fish and Wildlife Service and the EPA put a veto letter into the Corps of Engineers, and they delayed it. And unfortunately, you were not able to move the Obama administration to do what every Alaskan wanted then, which was to have that bridge permitted. I spent over 2 years as the DNR commissioner working with Senator Murkowski's office, industry, David Hayes at the Secretary's of Interior to try and get that decision reversed. We did, but it was another two-year delay. And then you're talking about celebrating NPRA. The Obama administration did take off half of the National Petroleum Reserve.
Thank you.
That certainly is true through executive order.
Thank you, Mr. Sullivan.
There's no executive order on the National Petroleum Reserve to take land off the table.
Hold on just a minute here, gentlemen. Dan, go ahead and ask your question.
Commerce is increasing in the Arctic, and nations are laying claim to the region. How do we protect U.S. interests best in the Arctic region off Alaska's northern coast?
Well, there are several things. You know, I support the Law of the Sea Treaty. There are some tweaks that need to be done, but generally the Law of the Sea Treaty needs to move forward. What's interesting is the Democrats support it, industry supports it, environmental groups support it, a lot of different military supports it. Where we can't get support is from the Republican side of the Senate. We can't get the 67. Senator Murkowski is one of the few senators on that side that support it. We need more support over there. But second, I think what we're doing now as chair of the Fisheries and Coast Guard Committee, we're adding more resources to the Coast Guard. We've written into legislation 2 years ago, as well as now the new bill that's coming up, to give more resources for the Coast Guard to have access and continue to develop in the sense of their forward basing that's necessary for the Arctic, because we need presence there. Along with that, the military has now recognized, I can tell you the first couple of years in office, they really didn't see the Arctic as very important until China and Russia and other countries said, well, we need to go up there. Suddenly now the military is very critical to what goes on there. And you see some moves very recently by Secretary of Defense and changing the way Alaska and who they report to. Why? Because that's important for the Arctic. So I do believe the Arctic is a critical piece to the future of Alaska and this country. But we now see for the first time more recognition. And the Coast Guard is part of it. The military is part of it. That Law of the Sea is part of it. But we don't have support from the Republican side of the Law of the Sea.
Okay. Mr. Sullivan, basically same question,
sure.
Arctic interests. What should the federal government be doing to...
Well, I think it's great opportunities for the state. And I think one of the things as a U.S. Senator that we need to be doing is making the case for the opening of the Arctic as a way, not only a great opportunity for Alaska, but for the country. So there does need to be more infrastructure in terms of ports. There does need to be more Coast Guard cutters. I think the Russians are outclassing us in those categories. We also have great opportunities, you know, up in Fairbanks, the university can play a very important role in terms of the research. So I think those are all critical, important areas to seize this opportunity. We do need to do a better job, particularly with regard to being ready on coastal spill response. But I'll tell you this, one of the things that was frustrating working with the Obama administration on getting them to recognize the opportunity of the Arctic is that they viewed Alaska as just another stakeholder. We were the same as the Center for Biological Diversity and all these other outside groups. What we kept arguing was we're not another stakeholder, we're the other sovereign. The only reason we have an Arctic opportunity is because Alaska. And I think it's important to have a federal government that sees us as a first among equals at the table on the Arctic, not just another stakeholder with a bunch of outside environmental groups.
Okay. So should the federal government fund things like a new icebreaker, Arctic port, very expensive infrastructure?
Yes.
All right.
Let me respond. Absolutely. My bill and the Coast Guard bill does just that, starts to move those items forward with the private sector as a partner also.
All right. We're running short on time. We have just a little bit of time left. Liz, you have a question on the Second Amendment and gun control issues. We've got about 30 seconds for each of your answers in this run. I'm trying to get the timing straight while we're kind
you're
of
doing
on the
a great
fly
job,
here.
I think. You're keeping us controlled.
both of you say you're strong supporters of the Second Amendment, but should there be regulations to prevent some people with certain mental illnesses or histories of violence from being able to buy guns without an additional level of screening? And how should such a system work, Mr. Sullivan?
Well, I'm not for additional regulations with regard to our Second Amendment rights. As a matter of fact, I think we have plenty of laws in place right now, even with regard to people with mental illness. And as a U.S. Senator, I'm going to be a very strong supporter. I was a strong supporter as Attorney General, was one of the AGs that participated in the Chicago versus McDonald case, which was one of the most important Second Amendment cases in the Supreme Court history, and I won't, you know, unlike, unfortunately, Mark, where he, you know, confirmed two Supreme Court justices who were in the dissent in Chicago versus McDonald,
right,
5-4 case.
Let me answer your question very specifically.
Yes,
first, as a lifetime member of the NRA, I get an A rating from the NRA. As you know, I took on the president. He and I didn't agree on his gun control legislation. But on this specific issue, actually, there is a problem in the in the way it works right now. Under federal law, if you have a mental, if you've been adjudicated by the courts that not to have a gun because of mental issues, the states, there's 20-some states that don't do that. 600,000 people don't have their records tied into the record for the federal government, who are deemed by the state courts to be mentally incompetent. So I have a bill with a Republican, NRA-supported, mental health provider supported to fix this problem because it's critical.
We are going to have to wrap up because we are out of time. Thank you so much. This concludes tonight's 2014 Debate for the State for U.S. Senate. Our thanks to Senator Mark Begich and Dan Sullivan, and also our panelists, Dan Bross and Liz Ruskin, for participating tonight. Election Day is November 4th. Alaska's polls open at 7 a.m. and close at 8 p.m. Please remember to vote. Thank you so much for joining us. Good night.